for the time being, however. The Mexican legends show, quite conclusively, that many, perhaps every, region of the world has its own traditions about such creatures and associates them very definitely with the idea of aerial, or even cosmic, origin. In the Tzeltal cosmology, the earth is flat and supported on four columns. At the base of these columns lives a race of black dwarfs, and Creighton points out that their blackness is due, so runs the Indian theory, to the fact that they are scorched by the sun when he passes close to them every night as he travels through the underworld. According to the Paiute Indians, California was once populated by a superior civilization, the Half-Muzufs. Among other interesting devices, they used flying canoes, which were silvery and had wings. They flew in the manner of eagles and made a whirring noise. They were also using a very strange weapon, a small tube that could be held in one hand and would stun their enemies, producing lasting paralysis and a feeling similar to a shower of cactus needles. How could primitive tribes better describe electrocution? It is interesting to gather such tales in America, but Europeans hardly have to go as far as that to find similarly interesting and forgotten episodes. The archives of the Roman Catholic Church are full of such incidents, and it cannot be doubted that many an accusation of witchcraft stemmed from the belief in strange beings who could fly through the air and approached humans at dusk or at night. Occasionally, these demons were seen in full daylight by many people. And in this context, I am not referring to the vague confessions obtained under torture from the poor men and women who fell into the clutches of the Inquisition, although this material would be quite worthy of a parallel study. I am quoting official records of the time, gathered from witnesses by clerics and policemen, of which sort of report the following account is fairly typical. In the early 17th century, the cathedral at Campercontin, France, bad on its roof a pyramid covered with lead. On February 1, 1620, between 7 o'clock and 8 p.m., thunder fell on that pyramid, and it caught fire, exploded, and fell down with a stupendous noise. People rushed to the cathedral from all parts of the town and saw, in the midst of the lightning and smoke, a demon, of a green color, with a long green tail, doing his best to keep the fire going. This account, which was published in Paris, is supplemented by a more complete version printed in Rennes. This latter version adds that the demon was seen clearly by all, inside the fire, sometimes green, sometimes blue and yellow. What were the authorities to do? They threw into the roaring fire a quantity of agni de, close to 150 buckets of water, and 40 or 50 cartloads of manure, to no avail. The demon was still there, and the fire kept happily burning. Something drastic had to be done. A consecrated host was placed inside a loaf of bread and thrown into the flames, and then blessed water was mixed with milk given by a nurse of above reproach conduct and spread over the demon and the burning pyramid. This the visitor could not stand. He whistled in a most horrible fashion and flew away. I can only recommend the recipe to the U.S. Air Force. 800 years earlier, that is, about 8.30, in the days of Emperor Lothair, creatures similar to the elementals were seen very often in the northern parts of the Netherlands. According to Cornel van Kempen, they were called Dames Blanches, white ladies. He compares them to the nymphs of antiquity. They lived in caves, and they would attack people who traveled at night. The shepherds would also be harassed. And the women who had newly born babies had to be very careful, for they were quick in stealing the children away. In their lair, one could hear all sorts of strange noises, indistinct words that no one could understand, and musical sounds. 64 In the last half of the 17th century, a Scottish scholar gathered all the accounts he could find about the Slemth and, in 1691, wrote a manuscript bearing the title, The Secret Commonwealth of Elves, Fauns and Fairies. Tm The Secret Commonwealth was the first systematic attempt to describe the methods and organization of the strange creatures that plague the farmers of Scotland. The author, Reverend Kirk, of Aberfoyle, studied theology at St. Andrews and took his degree of professor at Edinburgh. Later he served as minister for the parishes of Balquhidder and Abquhoyle and died in 1692. It is impossible to quote the entire text of Kirk's treatise on the secret commonwealth, but we can summarize his findings about elves and other aerial creatures in the following way. 1. They have a nature that is intermediate between man and the angels. 2. Physically, they have very light and fluid bodies, which are comparable to a condensed cloud. They are particularly visible at dusk. They can appear and vanish at will. 3. Intellectually, they are intelligent and curious. 4. They have the power to carry away anything they like. 5. They live inside the earth in caves, which they can reach through any crevice or opening where air passes. 6. When men did not inhabit most of the world, they used to live there and had their own agriculture. Their civilization has left traces on the high mountains. It was flourishing at a time when the whole countryside was nothing but woods and forests. 7. At the beginning of each three-month period, they change quarters because they are unable to stay in one place. Besides, they like to travel. It is then that men have terrible encounters with them, even on the great highways. 8. Their chameleon-like bodies allow them to swim through the air with all their household. 9. They are divided into tribes. Like us, they have children. Kirk notes that the Scots avoid all travel during those four periods of the year, and he adds that some country folk go to church on the first Sunday of every three-month period to have their family, crops, and cattle blessed in order to keep away the elves who steal plants and animals. Nurses, marriages, burials, etc., unless they just do this to mock our own customs, or to predict terrestrial events. 1. Their houses are said to be wonderfully large and beautiful, but under most circumstances they are invisible to human eyes. Kirk compares them to enchanted islands. The houses are equipped with lamps that burn forever and fires that need no fuel. 2. They speak very little. When they do so, when they talk among themselves, their language is a kind of whistling sound. 3. Their habits and their language when they talk to humans are similar to those of local people. 4. Their philosophical system is based on the following ideas. Nothing dies, all things evolve cyclically in such a way that at every cycle they are renewed and improved. Motion is the universal law. 5. They are said to have a hierarchy of leaders, but they have no visible devotion to God, no religion. 6. They have many pleasant and light books, but also serious and complex books, rather in the Rosicrucian style, dealing with abstract matters. 7. They can be made to appear at will before us through magic. The similarities between these observations and the story related by Fascius Cardan, which antedates Kirk's manuscript by exactly 200 years, are clear. Both Cardan and Paracelsus write, like Kirk, that a pact can be made with these creatures, and that they can be made to appear and answer questions at will. Paracelsus did not care to reveal what that pact was because of the ills that might befall those who would try it. Kirk is equally discreet on this point. And, of course, to go deeper into this matter would open the whole field of witchcraft, which is beyond my purpose in this book. Kirk's conclusion is that every age has left a secret to be discovered. Sooner than we think, he says, the relations with the aerial beings will be as natural to us as, say, microscopy or the printing press, navigation, all things that caused considerable surprise when they were first introduced. We can only follow him in this and give a humble salute to a man who managed to gather such a complete description of our visitors. It is remarkable that one cannot find a single writer who claims he knows the physical nature of the fairies. 14. They give us their personal opinions on the subject or report on the various theories held during their time, but they do not assure us they have a final answer. To Kirk, the good people have bodies so pliable, thorough the subtlety of the spirits that agitate them, that they can make them appear or disappear at pleasure. Some have bodies or vehicles so spongens, thin, and difficult, that they are fed by only sucking into some fine spirituous liquors, that pierce the pure air. According to medieval occultists, All invisible beings can be divided into four classes: the angels, the gods of the ancients, the devils or demons, the fallen angels, the souls of the dead, and the elemental spirits, which correspond to Kirk's secret commonwealth. In the fourth group are the gnomes, who inhabit the earth and correspond to mine haunting fairies, goblins, pixies, Corrigans, leprechauns, and the domovoys of Russian legends, and the sylphs, who inhabit the air. These subdivisions are obviously arbitrary, and Paracelsus himself will admit it is extremely difficult to provide definitions for these various classes. The bodies of the elementals are of an elastic semi-material essence, ethereal enough so as not to be detected by the physical sight, and they may change their forms according to certain laws. To start from this basis would naturally open the way to far-reaching speculations. From John McNeill of Barrow, whence learned, the old people said they didn't know if fairies were flesh and hood or spirits. They saw them as men of more diminutive stature than our own race. I heard my father say that fairies used to come and speak to natural people and then vanish while one was looking at them. Fairy women used to go into houses and talk and then vanish. The general belief was that the fairies were spirits who could make themselves seen or not seen at will. And when they took people, they took body and soul together. Another man interviewed by Wentz insisted that the fairies of the air are different from those in the rocks. Similarly, in Brittany, popular tradition divides the fairies into two groups: pygmy-sized entities endowed with magic powers and the science of prophecy, on one hand, and white, aerial fairies, on the other. Beings in the first category are black, hairy, their hands terminate in talons. They have old faces and hollow eyes, small and bright like burning coals. Their voices are low as if broken by age. With the remark about prophecy, we are led again to consider the relationship between the actions of the secret commonwealth and the affairs of men. Wentz, noting this relationship in ancient poetry, says that during the last fight of the great hero of Ulster, Cuchulainn, who was a favourite of the Cyhor fairies, one of these beings named Morrigan flew over Cuchulainn's head as he fought in his war chariot. Similarly, the fairies took part in the Battle of Clontarf, April 23, 1014, providing what would be called, in modern military language, air support for the Irish side. Before the battle, a fairy woman came to Dunlang O'Hartigan and begged him not to fight. She knew the issue could only be death, and here we find the prophetic powers of fairies again. Lye assured her that he was ready to die for Ireland. The two armies met near Dublin. It will be one of the wonders of the Day of Judgment to relate the description of this tremendous onset. There arose a wild, impetuous, precipitate, mad, inexorable, furious, dark, lacerating, merciless, combative, contentious bad which was shrieking and fluttering over their heads. And there arose also the satyrs and sprites, and destroying demons of the air and firmament, and the demoniac phantom host. This is only one of many references to the flying hosts of the fairies. We shall have occasion to study them more closely in a later chapter. But, first, let us return to UFOs. Can we study modern UFO reports without reopening the entire problem of apparitions? To most UFO writers, the answer is yes. Unidentified flying objects, they argue, leave physical traces and behave like space probes. It is obvious to them that UFOs are scientific devices having nothing to do with the mystico-religious context of medieval apparitions, and nothing to do with the creatures studied by Kirk, since, as we have just seen, these latter could appear and vanish at will. This view is no longer tenable. The reports of recent observations do describe objects that appear and vanish. It is just that, such reports are not publicized. Students of UFOs are reluctant to publish them. And the witnesses themselves are not eager to come forward with stories they know are unbelievable. During a discussion with Amy Michelle on this subject, he pointed out the negative reactions of scientists to his analysis of the French sightings. They argued that such fantastic stories could only come from deranged minds. What would these people have said, he remarked, if I had published all the data? among the cases that deserve close examination, but which were swept under the rug by UFO students themselves, is the sighting at Andouillette, Indre-et-Loire, France, near Marcilly-sur-Vienne on September 30, 1954. About 4:30 p.m. Georges Gattet, head of a team of 8 construction workers, found himself walking away from the other workers. He felt a peculiar drowsiness and suddenly wondered where he was going. Then, without warning, he found himself facing the strangest apparition. Less than 30 feet away, above him on the slope, was a man. His head was covered with an opaque glass helmet with a visor coming down to his chest. He wore grey coveralls and short boots. In his hand he held an elongated object. It could have been a pistol, or it could have been a metal rod. On his chest was a light projector. The strange man was standing in front of a large, shining dome, which floated about 3 feet above the ground. Above the cupola of the machine were objects like rotating wings or blades. Then suddenly, the strange man vanished, and I couldn't explain how he did, since he did not disappear from my field of vision by walking away, but vanished like an image one erases suddenly. Then I heard a strong whistling sound which drowned the noise of our excavators. The saucer rose by successive jerks, in a vertical direction, and then it too was erased in a sort of blue haze, as if by miracle. As soon as he saw the object and the entity, Gattet tried to run, but he found himself helplessly nailed to the spot. He was thus paralyzed during the whole observation. So were his 7 CO workers, in a unique case of collective physiological reaction. None of them had previously believed in the reality of the so-called sorcerers. As soon as he was able to move again, Gattet rushed back to his men and cried, "Have you seen something?" Mr. Burroughs told him, "Yes, a flying saucer." And the man who was the driver of the excavator, Mr. Lubanovic, added, "There was a man dressed like a diver in front of it." 4 others, Messrs. S.E.C.H.C.T., Vilknov, Rujic, and Amirat, a truck driver, confirmed all the details of the sighting. It must be pointed out that the incident took place in a remote rural region. At the time, the end of September, the French wave of reports was just beginning. But Gattet, who fought during the war with the resistance and was wounded in Luxembourg, said that he is not used to flights of fancy. Following the incident, he suffered from insomnia, strong headaches, and loss of appetite for a week. Ironically, the 8 men are still not convinced that flying saucers were from another world. They feel sure they are a secret development by a terrestrial nation, probably France. In Jalapa, Mexico, early in September 1965, a hovering object with luminous slits in its circumference and a black-clad being with eyes gleaming like a cat, holding a shining metal rod, was seen. The entity vanished suddenly while under observation in a Jalapa street by a local reporter, 2 taxi drivers, and a bullfighter. In the Carazano case of July 26, 1965, 5 dwarfs dressed in dark uniforms and small boots were seen. We are told that one of them had in his right hand a brilliantly luminous object like a wand. There was a sudden flash of lightning about 1:45 p.m. on January 28, 1967, on Studham Common, near Whipsnade Park Zoo, an isolated spot up in the Chiltern Hills, in England. Rain was falling and the atmosphere was heavy, reports R. H. B. Winder, who investigated this case for the Flying Saucer Review. 17 boys were on their way to school in the vicinity of the Dell, a shallow valley and an ideal spot for playing hide and seek. Alex Butler, age 10, was looking south over the Dell when he saw clearly, in the open, a little blue man with a tall hat and a beard. He called his friend, and they ran toward the figure. They were about 20 yards away when it disappeared in a puff of smoke. The boys were very much surprised, naturally, but nothing in their attitude of the strange figure had inspired fear or suggested threat, so they kept looking for the little blue man and saw him again on the opposite side of the bushes from where he was first standing. They went toward him. He vanished once more, reappearing at the bottom of the dell. This time, They heard voices in nearby bushes and became slightly afraid. The voices reminded them of foreign-sounding babble. Finally, they saw the man a fourth time before they were summoned to school by the whistle. Their teacher, Miss Newcomb, noticed how excited they were and, in spite of their warnings that she would never believe them, immediately separated them and made each of the seven boys write down his experience, each in his own words. The essays were then gathered into a book called The Little Blue Men on Studham Common, which, notes Winder, makes fascinating reading and no doubt will occupy an honored place in the archives of the Studham Village Primary School. Investigation by Winder, Moolster, Bowen, and Creighton disclosed a number of local sightings, among them two landings in the vicinity of the spot, within a few months of the January sighting. Naturally, the investigators were most interested in hearing the boys themselves give details on the appearance of the creature. They interviewed them in the presence of their teacher, and Winder reports, they estimate the little man as 3 feet tall, by comparison with themselves, with an additional 2 feet accounted for by a hat or helmet best described as a tall brimless bowler, that is with a rounded top. The blue color turned out to be a dim grayish blue glow tending to obscure outline and detail. They could, however, discern a line which was either a fringe of hair or the lower edge of the hat, two round eyes, a small seemingly flat triangle in place of a nose, and a one-piece vestment extending down to a broad black belt carrying a black box at the front about 6 inches square. The arms appeared short and were held straight down close to the side at all times. The legs and feet were indistinct. As for the puff of smoke, it apparently was a whirling cloud of yellowish-blue mist shot toward the pursuers. I hardly need to quote more cases. The magic casement. The Reverend Robert Kirk makes no bones about it. The elves did at one time occupy the land. Today it is still a common belief in the north of Scotland that the Scythe or fairy people existed, one say belief that survives in their title good neighbours, although they could occasionally be hostile to man, while the Scythe had no inborn antagonism towards human beings, and were occasionally known to do good turns to their favourites. They were very quick to take offence, capricious in their behaviour and delighted in playing tricks on their mortal neighbours. These cantrips had to be patiently endured, as resistance or hostility might lead to dreadful reprisals, the kidnapping of children or even adults. An attitude of passive friendliness on the human side was therefore assumed to be eminently desirable. Scott refers to this when Bailey Nicole Jarvie, in Rob Roy, tells his companion, as they pass a fairy hill near Aberfoylk, they catham, doi ein scythe, which signifies, as I understand, men of peace, meaning thereby to make their good will. And we may e'en as well catha too, Mr. Osbaldistone, for there's nae good in speaking ill o' the laird within his ain bounds. A Gaelic scholar, Campbell, minister of Tyree, published a story called Namuisjan, the Dwarfs or Pygmies, in which he remarks, the existence of pygmies in some unknown region bordering upon, if not forming part of, the Kingdom of Coldness is of interest as indicating some of the connection between smallness of person and cold climate, and so leading to the speculations as to the first dispersion of the human race and connection of tribes that are now far removed from each other in appearance, dress, mode of life, and dialects. Although the connection between climate and size is not a tenable hypothesis, Campbell's remarks do open the way to interesting speculations. He notes that the term Lapanash applies to a certain little, thick-set, insignificant man who figures in many tales, and, he adds, there aren't many traditional tales in the Highlands of much interest, in which little men of dwarfish, and even pygmy, size, figure as good bowmen, slaying men of large size, and powerful make, by their dexterity in the use of the bound arrow. In spite of their small size, they are understood to have been of very considerable strength. They were not undersized in the same way that children are, but full-grown individuals, undersized and sinew-apostrophe, or muscular. These dwarfs or pygmies are called Namuisjan or, more correctly, Amuisjan. The English phonetics for the Gaelic Amuisg would be Uisg. The same beings are sometimes found under the names Tamhusg and Amuish, and these words uniformly designated dwarfs. It is ironic, therefore, that in one talc, the lad with the skin garments, quoted by MacDougall, the Uisks address a human intruder as O little man while he in turn calls them big men all. Now one point must absolutely be cleared up. Were there or were there not traces of dwarfs living among the Western Middle Europeans of antiquity? Were the legends about the fairies and the elves based on the fact that the ancient inhabitants of the northern parts of the British Isles were such a race? Historical and archaeological researchers definitely say no, and we must agree with them. Yet several writers, such as David Makrychik, claim there are indications in this direction, and of course such indications would be crucial to any theory concerning the nature of the humanoids. In a book published in London in 1894, Tyson's Essay Concerning the Pygmies of the Ancients, Professor Windle, of Birmingham, remarks that a race of dwarfs supplied the best warriors and bodyguard of several kings. Tyson made an extensive study of the dwarf races and quotes the Greek historian Decius, Middle India has black men, who are called pygmies, using the same language as the other Indians. Of these pygmies, the king of the Indians has 3,000 in his train, for they are very skillful archers. And he adds, there seem to have been near Lake Zera, in Persia, Negrito, pygmy, black, tribes who are probably aboriginal, and may have formed the historic black guard of the ancient kings of Susania. Tyson's work, to which Windle provided the preface, was written in the 17th century. After calling attention to the remark by Ctesias, it goes on, Talentonius and Bartholin think that what Ctesias relates of the pygmies, as their being very good archers, very well illustrates this text of Ezekiel. The Ezekiel text in question appears thus in the King James Bible. The men of Arvad with thine army were upon thy walls round about, and the Gamadims were in thy towers. The Genevan translation printed in Edinburgh in 1579 also has Gamadims glossed valorous men. In the Vulgate, however, it runs thus, Filii Arvad cum exercituo supramuros tuos per circuitum, et pygmae in turibus tuis furunt. And indeed, the English Bishop's Bible of 1572 and 1575 does not have Gamadims but Pygmenions. Without going into further detail, it is clear that the Gaelic story of a guard of dwarf warriors is not an isolated case. If we return now to David Makrychik's quotation from the Flemish folklore journal Ons Volkslven, we can learn more. The Fenlanders, a race dwelling in our country prior to the Celts, were little, but strong, dexterous, and good swimmers. They lived by hunting and fishing. Adam of Bremen in the 11th century thus pictures their descendants or race. They had large heads, flat faces, flat noses, and large mouths. They lived in caves of the rocks, which they quitted in the night time for the purpose of committing sanguinary outrages. The Celtic people, and later those of German race, so tall and strong, could hardly look upon such little folk as human beings. They must have regarded them as strange, mysterious creatures. And when these Negroes or Fenlanders had lived for a long enough time hidden, for fear of the new people, in their grottos, especially when they at length fell into decay through poverty, or died out, they became changed in the imagination of the dreamy Germans into mysterious beings, a kind of ghosts or gods. In a footnote, Makrychik states that he is not aware on what grounds this author speaks of them as black people, but he admits that these dwarfish Fenlanders might be regarded as the originals of the Uisks of the Gaelic legend. Now we seem to be getting somewhere. There is a tradition in the Orkney Isles that offers a parallel to the above story. Sometime in the first part of the 15th century, Bishop Thomas de Lerc of Orkney gave details, in De Orcadibus Insulis, of the tradition that the archipelago had been inhabited 6 centuries earlier by the Papianda race of dwarfs. The Papi, according to many scholars, were the Irish priests, and the dwarfs were the Picts. In this, Makrychik follows Barry's Orkney, where we read, they are plainly no other than the Peaths, Picts, or Picts. The Scandinavian writers generally call the Picts Peti, or Pets. One of them uses the term Peter, instead of Pitland, Saxo Gram, and besides, the firth that divides Orkney from Caithness is usually denominated Petland Fjord in the Icelandic sagas or histories. The consistency running through these ancient accounts, MacRitchie says, is indeed remarkable.